People who live near mountaintop removal coal mining worried for years about how it might affect their health. Then researchers saw increases in the risks of cancer and birth defects.
I was naive and thought that maybe the evidence would speak for itself. But I've learned that that's not how things work in the coal fields of West Virginia.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, there might soon be answers to some of the questions surrounding mountaintop mining and public health. Plus, President Obama's climate policy gets its day in court. And a Jewish congregation in Pittsburgh makes some Rosh Hashanah resolutions by the river.
I would want to do recycling and compost.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has made its final decision on the state's natural gas law, known as Act 13. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports that it's a big win for environmentalists and municipalities, and a loss for the state and industry.
Almost 3 years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a major part of the state's new oil and gas law. It said towns should be able to decide where gas drilling takes place. But other issues with the law remained unresolved. On Wednesday, the court issued its final ruling, a majority opinion that says it's unconstitutional to use eminent domain to take land for natural gas storage. It also threw out the so-called Dr. Gag rule. That forced healthcare workers to sign non-disclosure forms in exchange for getting information to treat patients exposed to drilling or fracking chemicals. Jordan Yeager is the attorney who argued for the towns and environmentalists.
It's great for the residents of Pennsylvania to have the courts recognize that their rights matter more than gas industry's power in Harrisburg.
The ruling also says the state must notify owners of private water wells in the event of a hazardous spill. An industry group says it is disappointed in the decision, which it says will not help protect the environment or public safety. The governor's office says it's still reviewing the ruling. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Meanwhile, another court is weighing in on the nation's climate policy. A panel of 10 judges on a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C., heard arguments on Tuesday from 16 attorneys about the Clean Power Plan. It's the centerpiece of President Obama's efforts to deal with climate change. The Environmental Protection Agency rules are meant to cut carbon emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants by about a third by 2030. Each state is required to meet specific reductions based on its energy production. Governor Tom Wolf wants Pennsylvania to move toward compliance. Meanwhile, West Virginia's attorney general is leading more than two dozen states, plus businesses and industry groups, in the lawsuit challenging the rule. Reporter Emily Holden of E&E's Climate Wire was in the courtroom and joins me by phone. So, Emily, what was the atmosphere like? And sort of paint a picture of how important this court is.
This is a big deal for everyone in the power sector and for environmental advocates. And so we had hundreds of people lining up to go into the court. The court actually opened multiple overflow rooms because there was so much interest.
What's the crux of the argument being made by West Virginia and the other states against the Clean Power Plan in court?
The arguments really were focusing on this question of what exactly EPA is regulating. So EPA set these individual state standards. And the challengers are arguing that in doing that, EPA looked at the overall power system and said, well, it looks like we could have more natural gas, more renewable power, and less coal. There's this idea of a sort of trading system where these coal companies, they could buy credits to keep their plants online. And the challengers are saying that that's really not fair, that EPA should only be able to regulate coal plants specifically, that they shouldn't be able to sort of spur these changes in the broader power sector.
Is the legal issue here that the opponents think EPA is manipulating the market, or is this about regulating carbon itself?
No, that really didn't feature in as much yesterday. There have been previous court decisions that have established that EPA has authority and must regulate carbon dioxide emissions, but there's still that question of whether EPA overstepped its authority and whether EPA is, with this regulation, sort of legislating rather than regulating and stepping on the job that is traditionally more reserved for Congress in the view of the challengers in this case.
What do opponents of the plan want to happen?
Well, I think the opponents of the plan would be certainly happy if this rule were struck down, but also it would be a win for them if it were delayed, because it would give a lot of these power companies more time to make a shift.
What about the 18 states, the health and environmental groups that are defending the law? What's their argument?
They say that EPA really was trying to make this regulation more flexible and more affordable and follow this trend that's already happening in the power sector. A lot of utilities have already been pushing toward cleaner fuels. And they also really touted the health benefits and the climate benefits from this. The Obama administration has said that this is very important to international negotiations, to getting other countries to agree to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions as well.
Was there sort of a feeling that either side was winning?
We heard from observers on both sides that it seemed that EPA really had the edge, especially when they were talking about that bigger issue of how EPA would regulate the entire power system. It's really difficult to tell, though, where judges are headed.
What could these court hearings mean in coal states like Pennsylvania, where Democratic Governor Tom Wolf is facing opposition from the Republican-led legislature for going forward with the carbon reduction plan?
You've seen this rule really highlight a lot of the existing political divides in many states, not just in Pennsylvania, but so in Virginia, for example. The governor really wants to move forward with planning, but the legislature has said the governor cannot spend any more money on planning. In Colorado, you have the governor supportive of the Clean Power Plan, but the attorney general is suing.
So some states just don't want to move forward in case the rule happens to be struck down. They don't want to move in that direction until they have to?
That's right. Yeah, I think there's a sense, especially from some state legislatures, that before seeing the ultimate final rule, you know, it's possible that judges might say EPA has to change something, and that could be sort of wasted effort and planning. On the other hand, a lot of the advocates of the rule say that's not wasted. This is a question you're going to have to figure out no matter what. You're going to have to determine how to deal with carbon emissions under this rule or under a next regulation if this rule doesn't work out, or you know, eventually possibly through legislation from Congress.
Of course, the presidential election is really only weeks away. Hillary Clinton supports the Clean Power Plan, and Donald Trump does not. How would the outcome of the election impact what's happening now and the Clean Power Plan in general?
The election could be huge for a couple of reasons. So for one, this rule could probably go to the Supreme Court. Right now, the Supreme Court is only at 8 justices, and those are split 4-4, Republican and Democratic appointees. So the next president will get to appoint that next Supreme Court justice, who could be kind of the deciding vote. That said, justices don't always vote along partisan lines, so it's difficult to project.
You mentioned the Supreme Court. What are the next steps in this legal fight?
So the D.C. Circuit probably will not issue a decision until the end of this year or early next year. And then it's possible that we won't know whether or not the Supreme Court wants to take up the case until fall of next year. So it's very likely that we're not looking at a final resolution on this until 2018.
Reporter Emily Holden is with E&E's Climate Wire. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Want to see what Pennsylvania needs to do to reach its carbon reduction targets by 2030? Head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org, for an interactive graphic. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. In many religious traditions, rivers are ideal places to gather and perform rituals.
Water is considered one of the sources of life, but specifically an element that allows for renewal and rebirth.
Later on the Allegheny Front, one Jewish congregation in Pittsburgh celebrates the new year on the banks of the Monongahela. Stay tuned. Carbon emissions from power plants aren't the only aspect of the coal industry under close scrutiny these days. The National Academy of Sciences recently announced a study on the health effects of the controversial coal mining practice known as mountaintop removal. Coalfield residents have long questioned how the dust, blasting, and water contamination might be impacting their health. Research on the topic has often run into industry opposition, political roadblocks, and bureaucratic delays. But Benny Becker reports there is reason to believe that some answers to these health questions are now on the way.
Concerns about how surface mining affects the people of Appalachia go way back.
All you have to do is just look on the mountain to know that it's not best for the people.
That's Bruce Hatfield, a resident of Mingo County, West Virginia, from the 1979 Apple Shop film Strip Mining. In the years since, surface mining has gotten scaled up and evolved into mountaintop removal. Instead of cutting into the side of a mountain, it's become common to blast the whole top off to get at the coal seams below.
They're just leveling our mountains in here.
That's Ed Wiley speaking in 2007 about mining in his native Boone County, West Virginia. One mine was right beside his granddaughter's elementary school.
Tears were pouring down this little girl's eyes, and she says, "Gramps, these coal mines are making us kids sick." That hurt me. It was like a sledgehammer.
In 2006, Wiley decided he had to take action. He decided to protest the situation by walking all the way to Washington, D.C. At that point, very little research had been done, so Wiley didn't have much besides anecdotes to back up his arguments. But that same year, Michael Hendricks arrived at West Virginia University as a professor of public health. He soon started to hear worries about the health impacts of mining and the dust it puts into the air that people breathe.
I looked at the literature and found nothing that was done in the United States on public health problems related to mining.
So Hendricks decided to study it himself.
Many of my colleagues told me when I started that the health problems would be due only to things like poverty or smoking, but we were able to control for those risks, and I can literally remember the very first study hitting the run button on the computer and seeing that, yes, there really was something here. I was surprised.
Hendricks kept on studying the issue, and other researchers quickly followed suit. A number of studies linked mining to a variety of health issues for those living nearby, including increased rates of cancer and birth defects. Hendricks says the response to these studies was not what he was expecting.
When I started, I was naive and thought that maybe the evidence would speak for itself. But I've learned that that's not how things work in the coal fields of West Virginia.
Coal is West Virginia.
For years, that jingle was brought to you by Friends of Coal and the West Virginia Coal Association. Bill Rainey is the association's president.
I think Hendricks is anti-mining.
Rainey says he doesn't trust Hendricks' research and also thinks it ignores a bigger health concern, the loss of mining jobs.
If he wants to come to southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky coal fields today to see what unemployment and not operating mining operations has done to the health of people, when they don't have a job, then health suffers.
The mining industry sponsored its own studies to criticize Hendricks' research. One critic claimed that Hendricks' findings weren't reliable because they didn't account for consanguinity. That's the scientific term for inbreeding and an apparent reference to a baseless stereotype about Appalachians. And then Hendricks was called to testify in front of Congress, where he didn't exactly get a warm reception from Louisiana Congressman John Fleming.
I've seen fifth grade science projects that were more scientific.
You know,
than
I came here not to be insulted.
Yeah,
this
I'm sorry, sir, but I have the time. The time is mine. You should be embarrassed to be here with a study like this.
Hendricks isn't the only person who found that politics can become challenging when you start advocating for research on the health risks of mountaintop removal. In 2013 in eastern Kentucky, state, local, and federal officials formed an organization called Shaping Our Appalachian Region, or SOAR. The idea was to explore how the region can adapt to a changing economy and fewer coal jobs. Here's Jared Arnett, SOAR's executive director.
This is a huge opportunity to connect from the governor to grassroots in a unified effort.
What we'll do, since we've got a small group, is maybe just go around the room, tell who you are.
This is Dr. Nikki Stone. SOAR started off by setting up working groups to identify community needs, and Stone, she chaired the health group. They held 16 listening sessions, and she says people kept bringing up environmental health, including worries based on Hendricks' research.
It came out in every meeting. It came out very gingerly. So I think people have been afraid to talk about that issue for a long time, but it came up over and over, and it ended up at the top of our list.
In its final report, the working group advised that SOAR ask a federal agency for help studying the issue. Dee Davis was part of the working group and is also director of the Center for Rural Strategies.
The director of the CDC said, well, you make a request and we'll send investigators in. That was his promise at the public meeting.
Then the next time they spoke with the Centers for Disease Control,
we asked why we hadn't heard anything back. And the spokesperson there said she was not aware of any requests, but she would look into it and then get back to us. as far as I know, that was the last time anybody from CDC acknowledged the request.
It's not clear where exactly things got stalled, but here's what Jared Arnett had to say about why these concerns weren't a priority for SOAR.
It's about uniting, and a lot of the things that may not be a part of SOAR that people want to be a part of SOAR are very divisive.
Dee Davis, on the other hand, says that health concerns need to come first.
It's not really going to help us to sweep big questions about cancer and birth defects under the rug. If we're going to build an Eastern Kentucky economy that works, then part of that is making sure that our communities, they need to be places where people can live healthy lives, knowing that where they live is protected.
There's still no sign that the CDC is going to look into this issue. But with the announcement of two federally funded studies in the last year, the research is moving forward. A study by the National Academy of Sciences was announced just last month, and the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences also has research underway, which Director Linda Birnbaum described during a recent visit to Eastern Kentucky.
We're currently doing complete reviews of all the papers related to the health effects of mountaintop mining. Now, I don't want to prejudge our report, but my reading of the literature is that it's not good for people's health, and why would we be surprised?
I asked Michael Hendricks if he thinks these new government-backed studies mean we've turned a corner.
They are at least recognizing that there's an issue and looking into it in some fashion. I hope that that is a positive shift, but I'm going to wait and see what happens.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Ohio Valley Resource is a public media partnership from Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio, covering the region's economic transition. There's a timeline detailing the long history of health questions around mountaintop removal mining. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Plastic pollution is all around us, from grocery bags that aren't properly recycled to islands of plastic floating in the oceans. The technology demonstrated at a recent Green Products Expo in Pittsburgh is getting people to think differently about plastic's life cycle.
So what we got here is a mobile plastic recycling installation. We call it the Perpetual Plastic Project.
Bart Bleierveld is an industrial designer from the Netherlands. He drops an ordinary clear plastic cup, the kind you'd use at a party and toss out, into a shredder with a manual crank.
And we're turning. You break the cup down into small pieces.
The confetti-sized pieces then go through the extruder, a machine that heats the plastic up to 200 degrees and pumps the warm goo through a small hole.
It's a bit like a toothpaste.
The end product is a long plastic wire that becomes the ink for 3D printers. Bleierveld's company, Better Future Factory, uses an industrial-scale version of this model to make and sell printer ink from old car dashboards and refrigerators. For this demo, he's feeding a spool of the filament, the recycled plastic ink, through a 3D printer. It puts down fine, hair-like layers of melted plastic in different directions and creates...
It's a heart ring. You can have it.
Thank you.
Later, Bleierveld explains, though you can make just about anything on a 3D printer, the rings are part of his strategy at public events to pull people of all ages into how the perpetual plastic machine works.
I love the fact that when little kids, they walk through the steps and then 1 hour later, they come back with their parents and they're going to explain to their parents what the process is like. And that's amazing what people learn and their inspiration. It's not something you can put a number to, like, or which you could sell, but it's a bit of an intangible value that you create.
The concept behind your company and this demo and what you do is the circular economy. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
The circular economy, as we see it at least, we like to make our products on the local level again. And 3D printers offer us the opportunity to do that. But we still need to bring in the materials in order to power these machines. We need to bring them from far away. So we say, why don't we use the plastic waste we already have which we need to get rid of. Why don't we use that in order to power these local machines? We don't need to transport the products anymore, and we don't need to transport the waste anymore. So we can create a local loop, a local circle. There are different circles you can make. The first would be to reuse your plastics. For example, this plastic cup, if you take good care of it, you can use this maybe for 10 or 20 times. So that will already save you about 90% of the plastic cups you consume. Think about repairing your old products. There are some repair shops available, and especially with 3D printing, we can 3D print replacement parts for products that are broken. So we can extend the lifetime. So you would need less new products and less new materials. So recycling is actually the third step when you talk about how big is the loop.
Your company does sell printer ink. It's not really ink. It's
We call it filament.
And you sell those. They're made out of recycled car dashboards and other things, and they're used in 3D printers. So do people see more value in the final product because of where it came from? And is there a market for what you're selling?
There's definitely a market for 3D printing materials because it's getting more and more popular, and people all over the world have started using 3D printers. So there's a rising demand for materials, but there's also people that's starting to get more aware, because 3D printing is not a perfect technology yet. Like half of the time your 3D print would fail. And then people start to realize, like, okay, this is already the 5th, 6th, 7th time I'm throwing away my plastic. Like, can we not do something about it? And then our material is a really interesting alternative since it's already been recycled. And we work a lot with schools and universities that find it really important to have a more sustainable material to work with.
We all use plastic. It's everywhere. But I think when you're talking about the environment in plastic, plastic has a bad name. You know, people think of it as a negative thing. Do you feel like you're giving plastic a better name?
It is kind of funny, like people would think of plastic in a bad way, but it's actually a beautiful material. You can create it in all the colors that you want and all the shapes that you want. We can even make super lightweight packaging materials. For example, glass bottles are really heavy, so we save a lot of fuels by having plastic packaging. So it is a really nice material, but it's used in the wrong way. It is designed to last for a really, really long time while everybody is using it as a disposable. So if you start using it for products that need a really long lifetime, that's good. Or if you recycle it into new products and recycle it into new products and recycle it into new products, you can actually use the strength of having a long lifetime as a benefit instead of a problem.
Why is the work that you do important or meaningful to you? Like, what excites you about the work that you do?
I'm an industrial designer, and you work on new products that people can use. Yeah, so I worked at the design company before, and I made a new coffee machine and some other more consumer products and another coffee machine. But we already have so many different types of coffee machines. Why would we have a number 225 different type of coffee machine? It's not adding anything. They just want to have a new coffee machine so they can sell more coffee machines. And as a designer, at some point that felt like, why am I doing this? Why am I making another coffee machine? Where I can use my skills to make other products that, if we then sell the products to people, it actually has a positive impact because we use waste plastics. So the more products we sell, the more 3D prints we sell, the more plastics gets recycled. It just feels good.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bart Bleierveld is co-founder of the Better Future Factory in the Netherlands. There's more at our website, including a video of the Perpetual Plastic Project machine in motion. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Carol Holsapel. This is the Allegheny Front. Jewish people around the world will be observing Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, starting Sunday evening. Down by the banks of the Monongahela River, near the heavily used 18th Street boat launch, members of Pittsburgh's Temple Sinai congregation will gather for a holiday service known as Tashlik. Last year, we caught up with Rabbi Karen Gorbin and a few others from the congregation as they celebrated.
So today is Rosh Hashanah. It's the beginning of the Jewish year. It's a day when we celebrate the birthday of the world and also a day when we really begin the intensive process of cleansing the sins from the past year to enter the new year with a clean slate.
Okay, guys, we're just going to sing for a little bit and then we'll, a little closer to 5:50 we'll start. This has two parts.
So with the ceremony of Tashlik, we are casting out in a very physical way our sins. So we take bread, whether it's matzah that's left over from Passover or challah that's left over from their table. Again, the stuff that is left over that can muck things up. And then cast it away into water. So now people turn it into jokes like what we did before, reading about the different types of bread that you might use for different types of sins.
For exotic sins, French bread.
For sins of indecision, waffles.
For arson, toast. For being sulky, sourdough.
Water is considered one of the sources of life, but specifically an element that allows for renewal and rebirth. So the first time we really see this is actually in the story of Noah, where the flood comes to wipe out the violence that has destroyed the world. And the earth being entirely encompassed by water is like the world being reborn again. And so that continues throughout Jewish tradition, that all of the major rebirth moments come through water.
Everybody, it's time for bread chucking. Please be careful as you go down on the pier.
Tashlik? It means you throw bread in the water for what you want to do better at next year. I would want to do recycling and compost.
Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, kashelich os v'noach lirtzot. Praise be Water Nara, God, ruler of the universe, who is slow to anger and ready to forgive.
So we're standing in front of the Monongahela River near the Birmingham Bridge. It's a public place, so there are Jews and non-Jews. We've had people on jet skis, and you know, that's just part of life, is that we're mixed in with lots of other people, and hopefully they learn a little bit more about Judaism as they've been watching us standing and singing, and it's fun to just see life going on. Yeah. Rosh Hashanah is really about getting together and getting to know people and celebrating.
That was part of Temple Sinai's Rosh Hashanah service last year, held on the shore of the Mon River in Pittsburgh. Our audio postcard was produced by Lou Bluen. You can find more about life on Pittsburgh's rivers at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Look for the series Our Three Rivers. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front this week. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.